You are listening to The Big Interview, first broadcast on the 14th of February, 2016, on Monocle 24.
Hello, I'm Steve Bloomfield, and this is The Big Interview on Monocle 24, our one-on-one show where people with fascinating lives, enviable careers, and plenty of great tales sit down and tell us how they got to where they are today, what inspires them, and what makes them tick. My guest today is arguably the greatest living architect you've never heard of. Born in Ireland in 1922, Kevin Roche has learnt at the feet of Mies van der Rohe and Eero Saarinen, been practising for more than five decades, and has won the Pritzker Prize. But Roche is someone who is not as famous as his buildings. After Saarinen died, Roche and his future partner John Dinkeloo took on his remaining projects: the TWA terminal at JFK, Dulles International Airport, the CBS headquarters. The two men later set up their own practice. The Ford Foundation headquarters in New York is one of theirs, and the 93-year-old Roche still runs it today. And I'm pleased to say that Kevin Roche joins me now here in New Haven, Connecticut. Kevin Roche, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Can we go back to Ireland, where you were born, where you were raised, where you first studied architecture? You were studying there during the Second World War. What was it like to be studying at university while the world was changing around you?
Well, it was really very, very, very difficult because I went to the university in 1939 and started the architecture program. And it wasn't a particularly well-developed program because the man who had started it, he was still there when I started off. And his name was Rudolf Maximilian Butler.
And he was very a good name.
He was a very formidable personality. And he brought, there were only 10 students in the entering class. He brought us down to his office, which was in the basement, and he hummed and hawed a bit, and then he said, "There are no plums in architecture." And I thought to myself, thanks a lot. You know, here we are going to all this trouble to go through this thing, and we get this big negative warning at the beginning. But it was interesting in the sense that he was Greek revivalist, and so we spent our first 2 years drawing columns and entablatures and that sort of thing. And then in our third year, he had died by this time, so the new person decided to give us a break and said, design a house. Now, for us, this was really, really a challenge. And I designed a house which had a large circular stairs in the center of it. And I was so pleased with myself because I had never seen a stairs like this. It was a very, very grand thing. And I felt sure, you know, this was going to put me over the top with the instructor. And so I drew it all up and I had it all set and I made the presentation to the instructor. And he said in his Dublin brogue, after he looked at it for a while, he said, sure, you'd never be able to get a coffin down those stairs. And I was totally devastated. You know, of course, coffins are very prominent in Ireland. We seem to be all the time burying each other. But years later, I realized what a good comment it was, because inevitably in all buildings, in all projects, expect the unexpected, because it always happens. Something that you never thought about, some absurdity of some sort, always comes up, and you're stuck with trying to solve that problem.
When you graduated, it was the end of the war, you were in Ireland, you had this whole world around you which had changed dramatically. How did you start to think about what it was you wanted to do next, how you were going to take your learning and take on the world?
Well, of course, the first thing that happened, I got a job with the best office in Dublin. A man called Michael Scott was really quite a good architect and forward-looking. And one of the first projects that we had was what was called Bussaras, which was a bus central bus station, which I worked on a little bit. But then I got the job of doing some bus sheds. And so I came up with this idea, which is floating around, of doing a curved concrete roof on the thing. And so Michael Scott got Ove Arup, and we worked together on this bus station, and he did a wonderful design for it. But then we started another project, which was an apartment house, and I had proposed the idea of prefabricating the apartments and stacking them as building blocks. And I built an elaborate model of this, and Ove Arup came to look at it, and he said, no, that won't work at all. So I kept arguing with him, and finally he took the model I had built, and he threw it on the floor, and he stood on it, and he said, you see, it has no lateral strength. So that was my second lesson of don't argue too much with the engineer. They know what they're talking about. You don't.
You quickly moved from Ireland, from Europe, to the US, and that was to work with one particular, or to study with one particular gentleman, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. I decided to study with Miss van der Rohe, and with another member from the office in Dublin, we both went. We applied to Yale, Harvard, and IIT, where Miss was, and incredibly, we were accepted at all three of them. I couldn't believe it. But in any case, we flew to Chicago. When we arrived at Chicago, and in the car, the taxi going into the city, there was a song from a funeral home, they were selling funeral home services, and there was this very lively song. And we looked at each other and said, boy, what did we get into here? But then we got to the school, and Mies was absolutely wonderful. He never spoke about things very much. But you kind of, the aura of the seriousness of architecture was very important and was very good.
But was he difficult to work with?
He was not difficult. He was austere. And one of the first projects that we had was to design a house. Now, it had been snowing heavily in Chicago, so the house I designed had a pitched roof on it, which seemed like what the Scandinavians did. They would throw, of course, in the Bauhaus tradition, you simply didn't do a pitched roof. So I presented my pitched roof house to Mies, and he looked at it for a little while, and then he said, you could do that, but I would not do that, you know. And that was the only instruction I got from him the entire session I had there. So after I kind of ran out of money, after the first time I decided to hell with it, the United Nations had just been formed, and I was absolutely wanted to contribute some way to the United Nations of the world. And the building in New York was just about to start construction, and I thought, I can go and I can help, I can do something. So I got on a bus and went with my last few dollars to New York and went and begged them at the office, the architectural office, to hire me. And they did. They hired me as a file clerk, even though I'd had many years of practicing as an architect.
But you were quite happy to go
for
that job.
I really wanted to do it. So I started there as a file clerk. But after a few months, they put me on the drawings. And one of the things I had was detailing the end marble walls on the Secretariat building. And I'm always astonished when I drive down into New York and I see this, because they're still there, because I didn't know what the hell I was doing. And I had no idea how to detail or attach to the marble. But obviously somebody else must have got hold of it farther on down the road. But it was a great experience.
You talk about what it meant to you to be part of the UM project. Do you feel that your architecture is about sort of, you know, the impact that you can have on the world, not just on making a great building?
Well, I finally came to the realization, not quite just then, but gradually over the years, that what is the purpose of architecture? What is the purpose? And I realized that it has to be And it should be a commitment on the part of the individual to devote their lives to trying to improve in some way the built environment, the living environment, the environment for business, the environment for recreation, the environment for worship, if we're going to do that, that it has a special characteristic, and it is important that that is not just a piece of sculpture. It's important that it is, and I'm not just talking about function, I'm talking about the aura that it has that makes, that encourages you to want to participate in whatever it is you're doing and to do it very well. Now, as an example, I will say, you know, if you go to a Gothic church, it's an extraordinary experience. And you know that you're there, you have to worship in this particular way, in this particular religion. You know that that belongs to it. And it's not that somebody's yelling at you, you must do this, you must do that, you must do the other thing. But the atmosphere is so strong that it overwhelms any other ideas that you might be having or any other distractions that you might have. And somehow, if you could apply the what that does for the individual, if you could apply that to all of the other things. I'm particularly concerned about the work environment. I think we treat each other very, very, very badly in the work environment. And that is beginning to change a little bit now. But the idea of you're working in an office, and particularly if you're working in a city in a high rise, and you're stacked one on one on one on one on one up, and you're sitting in a little cubicle and you don't see anybody. If you go to the bathroom, you might meet somebody. But otherwise, it's just a life of total isolation. And you really, you know, the human animal is absolutely essential that they have a community. We're part of a tribe. We're part of a community. It's really important for us. Now, in a way, in the traditional sense, the village fulfills that requirement in much, much better than living in the city does, and living and working in the city. So that, because in if you live in a village, and I didn't ever want to do this, I wanted to get the hell out of the village I was in, but if you live in a village, you know people, you can talk to people, you can relate to people, there's some celebration, if you have a reason to celebrate, all of these things that are important to you. And the human animal is the worst animal on the planet. We destroy everything. And we finally, if we can overcome that terrible problem and begin to communicate with each other and begin to love each other, we will finally grow up. And now architecture can be an important part of that evolution.
If it is that important, and listening to you there, it's hard to argue with that case. Why do you think then so few buildings are built with that in mind? Is it a problem with architects who don't think that way, or is it a problem with those that are paying for the buildings that think, well, this isn't quite as important?
Well, you have to remember that many buildings are built purely as a financial investment. And so you have a developer who, understandably enough, is looking at the bottom line, and he sees an opportunity, and he decides to hire an architect, and the architect comes in waving his arms and proposing all kinds of nonsense, and he's still looking at the bottom line, and he's thinking, how the hell am I going to get this thing going? And I want it built tomorrow. I want to start making money. So his attitude is at total variance from the architect's attitude. And no matter whether the architect is really interested in the community idea, but the architect will be more likely be interested in the sculpture idea. How do we make something that will startle people and make me famous? You know, there's a big ego thing tied up in all this. So you have buildings emerging from this unhappy union of investment and ego. And that is what we know as architecture today.
And have you seen that change over the past 50 or so years? And if it has, is that in a good way or a bad way?
I'm not sure that it is really changing. You know, when you think about it, all of the classical architecture that we know from the past, all of the great architecture, it was all built by dictators of one form or another, church dictators or government dictators. And their interest is self-aggrandizement. You know, that's primarily why these great monuments are built. And we look at those monuments and we honor them. We regard them as an essential part of our history or our heritage. But when you think about why are they there, they're there because some guy has this huge ego and he wants to build a monument to himself, and that's what he does.
And have you ever taken on any of that sort of work, or have you gone into a project and then suddenly realized that essentially that's what someone's asking you to build?
Yes, I have, and it always is that true. But I always start a project from the user's point of view. And the users are two forms. There's the people who will actually sit or walk in the building, and then there are the people who walk by the building and will see it. I consider them both as users. And so for the people, I have great empathy for the office worker. I've designed something like 37 corporate institutional headquarters, and I've interviewed thousands of workers in all kinds of detail, you know, what would work for them, what does the toilet have to be like to be satisfied.
So that's part of your process. When you're building building, you need to speak to the people that are going to use it.
Absolutely, I have to speak to them. And in one project that we did, I said, why should we be telling them what kind of furniture they have? And so what we did was we did, I think, 12 different designs for the office, different furniture, different color, different light fixtures. And then each office worker was allowed to select the parts of the office they would like to have. That was just one effort to try and ease things. But I've moved on quite a bit from that now, and I strongly, strongly propose eliminating the office, eliminating the walls, and creating this sense, which is happening in many other parts of the world now in terms of what is happening in office buildings. But you create a community sense. People can sit in the open, they can see each other, they can chat, they can waste a little time, which we're entitled to do, you know, and they can work. And I learned a lesson. We were doing a research for IBM for when they were in the early days of the development of that company. And one of the scientists pulled me apart and he said, you know, the problem with an office building, you're isolated. And in our business, in the development in IBM, we need to talk to each other. We need to communicate ideas. He said, most of the good ideas that I've had, that I've come across, have occurred in the corridors. And that was a real lesson for me.
We talked a little bit earlier about Mies van der Rohe, but there's another big name from 20th century architecture you work very closely with, and that's Eero Saarinen. How did that come about, and what was it like working for him?
Well, I was laid off from the UN project, and I was hanging around New York totally broke. For about 6 months, I was paying $1 a day for room on the fifth floor, sharing it with a Mexican family. I had a friend who would occasionally give me a few dollars. I couldn't eat. I would go to the restaurant. I'd stand outside restaurants looking at people eating. And after about 6 months of that, I had a couple of friends, and one of them had heard that Eero was coming to New York and looking for some new help. And so she called and set up an appointment for me with Eero, and he's in the Plaza Hotel. Now, I had a cousin who had managed to become a small-time movie person, and she was on her way to Hollywood, and she stopped off, and we'd been very close. So for about a week, we went out in the town and drank ourselves silly every night, you know. And we went to Morocco and 21 and all these places. And so I'd been up all night to go before I went to the interview with Eero. And he was getting dressed when I went to the hotel because he had very little time. It was about 8 o'clock in the morning. And I sat on the edge of the bed, and Eero was putting on his clothes. And Eero talked very slowly and very seriously. And I just fell asleep. And I was sitting there on the bed, sound asleep. Fortunately, he didn't notice. But he did hire me. So I got on a bus and went out to Birmingham. And there were only 10 people in the office at that time. And he had acquired this enormous commission, $100 million, if you can imagine that, in 1950, for a research center for General Motors. And gradually, Aero and I managed to hit it off fairly well together, and I was assisting him. You know, he had many, many, many other projects, and I was gradually started to organize the projects so that he could come and make a decision about something. And so we got to be very friendly, and I traveled with him all the time. He was a wonderful, wonderful, brilliant architect. He could draw incredibly well, which I couldn't do. And he would begin a project by examining every conceivable aspect. He was truly a great architect. And the General Motors Technical Center, I think, is good evidence of that. And then, of course, he did many other things, but towards the end of his life, which was very brief, he did TWA, which was a big breakthrough, and the terminal at Dulles and the CBS headquarters. I was in New York. I'd been in Dulles, and I went to New York. I had a meeting with the client for the CBS headquarters. We were talking about elevators, and I got a call that somebody's calling me from Michigan, and I went out, and they called me to say the Aero had died. I was stunned because totally unexpected, but I decided to go back into the meeting and finish the meeting. That's exactly what Aero would do. He wouldn't let a thing like somebody dying get in the way of completing a meeting. He was very so narrowly focused in something like that. So I went into the meeting, and when we finished, I told them, of course, all hell broke loose because they thought they'd lost their architect. So then we had to do quite a bit of persuading for them to allow us to continue and develop the building and finish it.
And then you and John Dinkeloo ended up carrying on a number of those final projects.
That's right. John had been in charge of what we call the production, which is the actual development of the construction drawings and supervision of the construction. So we had been good friends, and we decided to continue on. And then the Aero had been invited to participate in a competition for a museum in Oakland, and we asked them if they would allow us to come. So I made a design and made an elaborate presentation and managed to beat out 30 other architects. That was a big breakthrough, and that happened within weeks of Aero's demise.
And then you and John worked together for quite some time. How did that relationship work?
That was very good. We clearly understood he was going to do his thing, I was going to do my thing. And we had a good relationship. We never argued about anything. Then he was, I'll give you an example. I had been drinking with an Irish friend who had come to Birmingham, and I was saying, in one of those attitudes, I was saying, I don't know why the hell we can't tear down a building after 10 years. Why do they have these things? Give an opportunity to the next generation of architects. And I said, why not build a building that'll just fall down? And I was telling John the next morning, and he came up with the idea of this weathering steel, which he went right at it and found some people who were building light poles out of this, what now became known as Corten, and got some samples built of that. And that became the basic element for the Deere and Company headquarters in Moline. So, he had that ability to pick an idea and bring it into reality.
We've talked a lot about office buildings, but if you look back at your career so far, the other strand that stands out is museums. You've worked on a number of museums. You've been the main architect at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York for decades. How do you approach a museum? Is there a different process for you?
Well, it's very interesting because people go to museums, and I've watched thousands of people in museums. I've gone to museums all over the world to study how people react to them, and they don't see anything. They just walk around. And one of the few in Paris, you see, of course, the Mona Lisa. You'll see a crowd of people standing there. But the rest of the museum is pretty much empty, you know. So the question becomes, how can you do something that will encourage a person to understand what they're looking at? Not specifically a painting or a sculpture, but to understand the human desire to create this art. And what is art? And we try to introduce that at the Metropolitan, in the paintings galleries, for instance, in the American wing. We kept the room small, not pretentious, not almost living room size, so that the paintings, as I kept saying, would be comfortable in the space. So we avoided designing exotic galleries or anything like that. My guiding rule was to not do something in the museum that distracts the viewer, but rather something that accommodates the painting or the sculpture appropriately and to scale and with the right kind of lighting.
You're 93 now, and yet you're still working every day. You're in the office every day.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
Why is that important to you?
I'd go mad if I didn't work. I really would. What the hell would you do? Just sit and watch that stupid television all the time? You know, I can't, unfortunately, my eyes are deteriorated, so I can't read. I used to read very, very much. When I left Ireland, I carried two bags. One had my underwear in it, and the other had my collection of poems, 19th century poetry and 20th century poetry, and all of James Joyce's writings I had acquired.
Had you read them all?
Oh, I'd read them all many times, and I was absolutely obsessed with James Joyce. And, you know, I could recite sections of Ulysses, you know, extemporaneously for years.
I might test you on that later.
It is, well, you know, don't you, Kenneth, or haven't I told you, every telling is a tailing, and that's the he and the shaver. So I can go on like that for a while. But retirement doesn't occur to me. What the hell do you retire? You see, that goes back to the other problem with the reason people retire is because they've had these dead-end jobs. They're not using their minds. They're not energized by what they're doing. Whereas I am energized very much by what I'm doing all the time. I'm very excited about it. And I think it's a great opportunity to be able, on two levels. One is to be able to make a contribution to the environment, and the other is to satisfy your creative desires to create something sculpturally or visually that's attractive and interesting and beautiful.
Kevin Roche, thank you very much indeed. You've been listening to The Big Interview with me, Steve Bloomfield, in conversation with Kevin Roche, recorded at Firehouse 12 in New Haven, Connecticut. The Big Interview is produced by Bill Luty, researched by Guy Lutz, and edited by Nina Narek. My thanks to Greg DeCroster here at Firehouse 12 in New Haven. Don't forget to subscribe to this and any of our other programmes on Monocle 24. You can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, or of course, monocle.com. Do join us next week when we sit down with the Nobel Prize winning economist, Joseph Stiglitz. My name is Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.